Hello, this is John Timmerman from Physical Living, and with me on the phone today is Mark Wildman, who is a fitness, movement, and fighting coach, whose primary clients are professional athletes and Hollywood celebrities. Mark owns Wildman Athletica, where he trains his clients in some unconventional skills, such as kettlebell training and clubbell training, sword fighting, self-defense, and the aerial arts. And today I'll be picking his brain about his unique training style. I want to talk martial arts, self-defense, fitness, aerial, just, you know, the whole gamut. And Mark says he's got plenty of time, so I'm going to hammer him with questions and see how much I can squeeze out of him. So, Mark, welcome to the call, and thanks for making some time to chat with me today.
Howdy, sir. Pleasure to be on.
All right. Well, can we just start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and you know, what you do today, just to give people who aren't familiar with you a little context.
Okay. My name is Mark Wildman. I live and work in Los Angeles, California. I work primarily with actors for athletic coaching. I've been here 17 years now, probably. I don't know. I'll have to think about that. I'm getting old. Been here for quite some time, working now in the movie business, work with circus performers and stunt people and people in the performance industry. Athletic coaching.
Awesome. Yeah. And I noticed I checked your LinkedIn. There's not too much information about you online. I had to like dig deep. But I saw you've got a lot of kettlebell credential certifications. You're a CST and TACFIT instructor. You've got some firearms instructor quals. And so you've got kind of a diverse background. And I thought that was really cool, which is why I wanted to get you on here. Now, what caused you to want to get involved with the health and fitness community? Why fitness? Why is this what you do?
Well, I grew up in Ohio, and I grew up on a horse farm. My mother was a horse riding coach, and we lived on a kind of a weird and unique place called it's now called Facet Farm. Back then, it was called Briar Hedge, and it was a place that worked with basically special needs people, special needs children, people with physical disabilities, various types, mental and physical, autism, cerebral palsy, all these different types of things. And they used horseback riding as a way to engage people outside of the way that they're normally being engaged, and basically using it as a form of physical therapy, but not really physical therapy, because it was somewhere not physical therapy. It was engaging people in something that got their mind active in a different way or caused them to desire to move their bodies in a different way. It gave them a need to do things. So I started in my youth by being opened up to all of this idea that, you know, athletic training isn't just for the athletes. Training is really necessary for everybody. And the people who probably need training more are probably the people who are not athletes. And that there should be some type of training that's focused on making these type of people better, having a higher quality of life. So I started with that, seeing that idea, getting into martial arts like every kid in the 80s did, and then wrapping all that together with scientific background, and trying to come up with better ways to help people, better ways to engage with people. So kind of a rough outline of how the whole thing started. I ended up at USC studying biochemical engineering. Did 5 years there, research science, lots of math, the whole time still doing martial arts, but still having this idea percolating in the back of my mind that there have to be better ways to do everything. There has to be a better way to engineer an outcome than just what I was being exposed to. Gym training seemed very lackluster. Martial arts training seemed like maybe sometimes it was missing the point. So trying to pull all these ideas together from an engineering context and think about it in a different way.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, well, I really dig that. And I'm sure, like, with your science background, I can see that in some of your work. And I assume that's part of what drew you to CST. Can I also ask, you know, like, why did you, can you tell us what Wildman Athletica is, and you know, why did you found it? What were you hoping to accomplish with your business that wasn't being offered by other, you know, gyms and other training methods?
I see when I'm out training at different places, because I like to go out and I like to train a lot. I like to train a lot of different places. I like to train a lot of different things, because that's how you get good at your job. You see what other people are doing. And then there's almost always like a mathematical hole in what they're doing somewhere along the way. And you can usually find it pretty simply once you have a general idea of what you're looking for. And so my goal is to take all the things that I want to do and fill in all the major holes that I see in training. And like you take a one really good training idea and you find one major hole in it, and then you can, if you fix that one hole, the whole idea gets back to being what it wants to be. So I'm constantly looking for holes and trying to fill them for my clients, because many people come to me because they can't, they're not getting, they don't know what they're looking for, but they know that there's a hole in their training someplace. So they come to me, tell me what they want to accomplish. I figure out what the hole is. We figure out how to plug that hole.
Yeah, I hear you. And I think that works really well when you have like a diversified background, and you don't just specialize in one thing. You know, like, you know, for you, it's not, you're not just a fitness coach. You know, you also train in combatives and aerial work and work with different types of people. And so I feel like people who have kind of that more of a generalist approach, where they specialize in a lot of different things, they have a unique perspective and can solve problems more easily than those who are super specialized. So, I hear you.
I like the way I teach aerial is very similar to how you would teach fight training. It's not how a normal aerialist teaches aerial at all. Normal aerialist is a dancer, and they teach everything like dance. The problem is if you weren't a dancer, you can't learn like a dancer can. But the majority of people who come to me are not dancers. So I train the majority of people in aerial, but I really use a martial arts training context for them, because I can then get around the fact that I wasn't a dancer and they're not a dancer.
Right. Cool. All right. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about circular strength training. This is how I first, I can't say I really ever got to know you, but you actually helped me out on the RMAX forums like probably 10 years ago when I was a CST newbie and I'd ask these dumb questions. And I, you know, I don't remember all the things you helped me with, but I remember that whenever Mark Wildman would share something, it was always a unique insight, you know. So
it was probably a super nerdy response.
I don't remember, but it was like you had a unique perspective, and that stood out from a lot of the other answers. And so how did you get into CST, and like what kind of, you know, how has that influenced you? What kind of impact has that had on your training and your coaching? You know, I'd like to learn more about that.
CST is a really good idea of something that I was trying to create anyway, and somebody had just beat me to it. I obviously did martial arts for a long time. I did kung fu, and when you're doing kung fu, you like most kung fu nerds, you go off and you try and find the old school secret knowledge that's out there. So you're out there and you're reading a lot about how did they used to train? Why are we not training that way anymore? There aren't really any reasons why we don't train the way they used to train, other than we're Americans. We just don't think that we should have to. So you're going through and you're reading all this old school information about the ways that they used to get strong and the way that kung fu people used to train. And I always kept coming across this one tiny reference. It'd always be a sentence in a book here, a sentence in a book there about Chinese kung fu called like melon hammers. And melon hammers were this a style of martial art where they used short clubs two-handed the same way you would use, say, two-handed swords, but they used them essentially as a strength training modality in a kung fu form. And so that idea, I was like, well, that sounds exactly like what you want to do. You want to get the footwork in the right place. You want to get the body movements correct. You want to be able to load things. We want to be able to use levers because levers make us stronger. And so I kept trying to find any type of information on that one thing. And you know, I went to China for 3 weeks, wandered around, tried to find somebody who knew anything about it, couldn't find anybody who knew anything about it, kept reading, found a Japanese version of the art called Chishi that they use in some of the tiger styles of Japanese martial arts. But that's kind of really kind of a chopped up, just like a couple of basic exercises. There was no science behind it. There was no frequency, intensity, time, or type. It was just kind of out there as something that traditionalists did. Stumbled across a couple of other things. And somewhere along the way, that was right when CST started being created. And I think I read my first reference to CST on an RKC forum someplace. And finally, after, I don't know, maybe a year, I finally figured out, because it was, you know, internet was kind of new. People didn't really have all that many computers and everything back then. Internet access was a lot more limited. Everything was a lot slower. It was before the age of smartphones. You couldn't just look things up. You had to actually kind of figure out where they were first and then go in and figure out how to get access to them. And I stumbled across a reference to CST someplace, looked it up, found back then there was like a CST online magazine where people published articles or wrote down observations and thoughts, and it just seemed very similar to what I was looking to accomplish. I was looking to accomplish a Kung Fu strength training goal, and here were some people who were doing basically the same thing, but from an entirely different point of view. The goals were the same. The ideas were the same. It was just a completely different direction that it had come from. So that's how I originally stumbled across CST. What else are we talking about, CST? Sorry, I get kind of rambling.
I was just wondering, you know, like for me, CST, you know, was huge for me personally and for my career. Just it changed, well, not changed, but, you know, it did change a lot of things, but it really systematized a lot of things that were more of a random collection of tools and strategies that I've been using. And it did introduce me to some brand new stuff that I was new to, like joint mobility training and compensatory movement and stuff like that. But the biggest thing that I got from CST was it was organized, it was well thought out, and so, you know, what kind of impact did it have on you and your training? You know, what changed after CST got into the mix? Obviously, you started training with club bells, but what else was going on?
You know, everything that you said, CST is organized. It has frequency, intensity, time, and type. Frequency, CST is a scientific strategy of looking at something, you know, creating a question, coming up with a theory, trying it out, and seeing if it influenced your outcomes. You know, I was already at that point a trainer working in Hollywood. I had already done RKC, you know, trained Kung Fu every day and all these things. But what CST was really gave a rough systemization of things that we should be working on. I mean, for me, the biggest thing was the club bell mill, an exercise that I had been doing for years with sledgehammers already and with handmade tools and all these other things. But taking the ideas of CST and the club really is just a better tool. You know, if you swing a sledgehammer around, like I can do it, but I can't get my clients to do it, they hit themselves in the head, they're going to kill themselves. Steel clubs, all these other things are just kind of bad approximations of what a good club bell really is, something that's actually of the correct length, has the correct weight distribution. And CST fills this one gap that no other form of training fills, which is lateral stability of the entire body. In normal gym training, you have your kind of functional training. You have your three directions that you tend to move, you know, up, down, forward, back. If you get into a crazy functional fitness guy, you might get some stepping left and right. But all of your pushing is overhead or in front. RKC changed the whole idea because now that there was traction, something was pulling against you and you were pulling back. And RKC was a huge, huge step in the right direction back then. But the problem with RKC was, is that it only, once again, moved in that curvilinear pattern front to back. Club bells came in, and club bells are, you know, they're fine front to back. You can do swipes and everything else, but that's not really where they shine. Clubs really shine in adding a whole new dimension of lateral stability of the spine to your training. So you can take any athlete, any actor, any person, anywhere, firefighter, policeman, anything, and if you start teaching them the lateral movements, mills, reverse mills, and all the movements that build up to those, you will add to them something that they have never, ever had before in their life that's been systematically trained, and that will create more change than you can get from almost anything else.
Yeah, I've found it's the same exact thing with me. It's like those movements, they are so not trained in our day-to-day life and even in the conventional gym crowd, and if there's a learning curve involved when you first, like, is this safe for my spine? I've heard people ask. And it's like, well, when you progress mentally, gradually, with good technique, with a light enough load and all that stuff, yeah, it can be trained very safely. And once you build up, you're right, you enable yourself to become a more complete athlete, which is another thing that I think CSC is really strong on.
Yes. So you fill in all the gaps that people probably have. I mean, you can take any firefighter, deadlifts and does all this crazy picking up heavy stuff. And the guys who come to me, they're wildland firefighter guys. They carry around a 70-pound chainsaw on their shoulder and they ruck up the sides of the mountains to fight fires. And they all have a spinal injury in the same spot. And all you do is you hand them a 10-pound club belt and you start teaching them how to mill. And they go from being unfunctional back to being fully functional very quickly because you've just filled in that one piece of spinal stability that their spine wasn't doing, that it didn't know how to do, wasn't systematically trained. And you take somebody and suddenly their firefighter time, their testing time start going up and all these other things. You didn't teach them anything fancy. You just taught them how to do the basics of milling in an increasing, in a logical way, up to maybe a 20-pound club. And they're only doing it twice a week, and they're getting such a huge benefit out of it.
Right.
You know, so CST fills this huge niche of having, like, lateral movement. Nothing else has that. And then CST has the best philosophy of anything out there. It's the only one that actually has, like, a scientific underpinning of not just doing a bunch of stuff and trying it out. It has frequency, intensity, time, type. It has the, you know, 7 key components of structure, the 6 degrees of freedom, 5 levels of breathing, the 4 T's, all that stuff is wrapped up in there. And the more you look at everything, the more you're like, well, I guess, you know, CST is covering almost all of these bases very, very effectively.
Right. Yeah, and I've heard it said that, you know, CST is like using a scalpel to attack a fitness goal rather than a pickaxe, you know, like with your the firefighters, you know, you figured out exactly what all these guys were lacking, whatever the deficiency was. You plugged in an exercise twice a week, and it's magic. You know, the problem's gone. And that's something I've found really valuable for CST. It helps you focus on what's the objective and what makes the most sense to go and to get this the most directly. So,
yeah,
good stuff. All right, I want to talk martial arts a little bit. You know, you've obviously had an extensive martial arts background. I'm sure it's impacted your views on health and fitness and how you do things. What are some lessons that you've learned from that background that you can apply to fitness training?
I always look at martial arts as the original systems of health and fitness on the planet. Like, you know, long before anybody invented a barbell, we were swinging machetes at each other. And then people decided that they should create a way to swing machetes at each other better. So I think that martial arts give you that the one basic idea of, like, what fitness really probably should be, or at least what it has been through every culture all throughout time. So when I think about a lot of this stuff, I get a little bit nerdy and I start thinking back, like, what are the common movements? What are the things that people did, you know, 10,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 100 years ago? And then what is that different from what we're doing now? And when you look at a lot of traditional martial arts, you see fitness as a life philosophy, as a cultural philosophy, and as a form of exercise that helped to keep people, prepared for the world that it might happen to them. So martial arts is like, it is what I do. You know, I don't tell people that that's what they're doing. I don't tell people that basically we're just doing kung fu. We're just doing a really nerdy scientific version of kung fu. But that is basically all we're doing. Philosophically, it's just we're putting hard work into fundamental movement patterns of the human body. The fundamental patterns of the human body are those that are probably most likely to be used for defense. So it's just like ripping out all the cultural context of martial arts and going back to what they were at the beginning, which was just fitness for defense. And then that's how I think of what I do. I don't really think of what I do as, you know, modern fitness training. We don't do bench. We don't do barbells of any type. We only worry really about the basics of footwork, but not footwork that's specific to any type of specific martial art. We don't do boxing footwork. The closest thing that we always come back to is Chinese style Kung Fu, because that was the one that has basic stepping patterns and everything and basic movement patterns all the way through. And then we just systematize that, turn that into something that we can break down with numbers, math, and science and get a predictable result in X amount of time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, martial arts are that underlying thing in everything that I do. Everything should have flow. You should be able to respond quickly to immediate needs. And, you know, so I keep studying martial arts. You know, I did Aikido for years, Kung Fu for years. I did Krav Maga. I did all kinds of weird things where you go in and you train with people. Xing Yi, a little bit of boxing here and there. But taking all those things and then wrapping them up and then being like, okay, what are the things that are constant in all of these different things that we do? Okay, we have to move our feet. We have to stay, give it the right distance. We have to apply force at X amount of range in the right angle. And everything is based on creating that idea.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, good movement is good movement, period, whether you call it Kung Fu or something else. And when you're, when you focus on, you know, just the most straightforward way to help somebody progress in their own personal fitness journey rather than trying to conform to establish a pattern or system, I think that they not only do they progress faster and become more of a complete athlete, but it seems like when it comes to mastering those different arts and systems, it comes faster, it happens more naturally when they pursue their own individual development rather than trying to, you know, repeat a form over and over and over again.
Yeah, I kind of gave up on forms and everything a while ago because I realized that, you know, it wasn't actually getting me what I wanted out of training. Like every time you go to a martial arts school, you have to like figure out like if what they're doing is what you actually want to accomplish. Does what they're doing line up philosophically with like the way that you want to do things? So if you go to a boxing coach and you always train with one hand and one leg forward, but then somebody pulls out a gun and points it at your face from the other side of your body, like if you haven't practiced stepping that one way and you have been training with gloves on and you're not used to grabbing things, like, so, okay, so maybe boxing doesn't meet the need of what I'm trying to accomplish with my training. But you go through all your martial arts and you try and pull little things from everywhere to get the idea of what you want to accomplish and then figure out a way to accomplish it.
Right, right. And like you said earlier, like you look for the common themes, the common denominators. What do they all have in common, and how can I master those?
Yeah.
What you know, I'm not a martial artist. I've done self-defense training, but I've never done, you know, Kung Fu or anything like that. What should somebody be looking for when they're looking for a martial arts instructor? You know, you mentioned that, you know, you got to evaluate each school. And I know some schools that are, they market themselves as reality-based self-defense. Others are the more traditional arts. And, you know, I know enough about self-defense to know that some of these schools are teaching things that are illegal. You know, you can't just assault somebody just because they hurt your feelings, right?
Yeah.
So how would you instruct somebody or recommend somebody would evaluate a school and find a good school that aligns with your values and your interests?
Most important thing in martial arts training is actually physically contacting something when you hit it. So, the problem with like almost all Kung Fu schools is that you spend a lot of time punching and kicking the air. So you learn really good movement, but you never learn what it's actually like to strike something. So your body doesn't learn the little lineup behind what has to happen for real. What happens when you really hit something? So that's like a huge problem that I find with something on one side. On the other side, you have your reality-based martial arts. And they tend to completely skip over the fitness of fighting as something that's necessary. So they spend a lot of time, you know, making loud noises and hitting stuff, but, you know, they don't worry about their squat pattern. And then, you know, so they're not really effectively moving their feet because they really don't have effective use of their legs. So what you're looking for in a martial arts school is a place where you hit things.
Hey, is that you, Mark?
Yeah, sorry. I don't know what happened to the phone there.
Sorry. You were just telling me about what to look for in martial arts training.
Look for a place where you actually hit something. Look for a place where people apply force to you. They don't agree with you all the time, but they have to agree with you a little bit. So this is kind of a weird place. Like in Aikido school, people tend to agree with you too much when you're practicing a technique. In a lot of reality-based martial arts systems, they tend never to agree with you at all. So on one side, you don't learn what it's like to have actual opposition. On the other side, there's so much opposition that you can never learn to effectively and use the technique that somebody's trying to tell you to use. So you're looking for a place where you hit things, where you move your feet, where it's not one-sided, where you don't always train with one leg or one hand forward, and a progressive structure from agree to disagree with you on the physical scale.
Mm-hmm. All right, I got it.
If you find some place that allows you, that puts on helmets and you practice actually hitting each other in the face, gently at first and building up more intensely over time, something like that is what you're looking for. You know, physical contact, incremental progression.
Yeah. And it seems like that's kind of like the missing link in most martial arts training from what I've observed is there's a lot of practice. So there's not a lot of, even sparring. You know, a lot of arts, they do sparring, but there's not a lot of competition where you're facing a resistant opponent who's trying to beat you. And
yes.
And so I feel like that's the secret sauce. Like, kind of, if you're using it for self-defense purposes and not just to, you know, break a sweat and get a good workout, yeah, you got to face that opponent. That's critical.
Yeah. So resistant opponent is key, but, you know, oftentimes in competition you can't do the types of things that you actually want to train. So you want to train gun takeaways. There's no competition for gun takeaways, right? So there have to be some scale where your training, where your partner lets you get the gun and then doesn't let you take the gun, you know, goes back and forth. Or when you get the gun and you don't move back, he takes the gun back away from you and punches you with it, you know, lets you know. So there's a whole scale that slides up and down from resistant to non-resistant. The problem with competition is that there's no competition where you're fighting three guys in an alleyway. So there has to be some type of scenario-based training as well in your training. So there's a big checklist of things that you're looking for in fight training. You know, you really only need, like, maybe 7 techniques that you need to work on in the beginning: punch, hammer, fist, elbow, forearm, strike, knee, front kick, kick to the groin. Let's say that's your basic list. You need to do all of those against a human-shaped target a lot before you need to get to anything else. And then you start need to adding in slow resistance over time. Martial arts training should all have modern weapons in it. You know, I love Kung Fu and everything, but you probably not the best use of your time in the Western world to practice defense against the spear. Is it a great examination? Yes. I think you should totally do it at some point to think about it, but it shouldn't be the thing that's focused on the most. But, you know, weapons training that you should focus on is probably machete fighting, because machete fights happen all over the world to this day, all across Africa. So that's a viable thing. Baseball bats, you know, broken bottles, guns are a huge one. You know, practicing gun takeaways, you should know how to, you know, the basics of how to take a gun away from somebody, and you should know what to do with it once you have it. So that's kind of asking a lot from a modern martial arts school. I don't really know of any that do all of those things together at one time. Except I think there's one guy in Kentucky I know who does all that stuff.
Right. Yeah, I know one guy locally who does all that stuff, but he's strong in, you know, the firearm stuff. He's not so strong in the other stuff, but it's so it sounds like what you're saying is it's a good idea to get a broad exposure and experience to a lot of different stuff.
Yeah, you're not going to get it all at one place. You're going to have to this is an idea that I actually got from CST a long time ago, and it's that you have to be your own master. You have to stop putting somebody up on the top who tells you exactly what to do all the time, like in a class of in a classical martial arts perspective. Your master guides all of your training. And that's not an effective strategy anymore in the modern world. You now have to be your own master, and you have to go seek out training for yourself in other places, because your martial arts master is running a martial arts school. He's probably not running a tactical firearms school. So you're going to have to go out and find tactical firearms training someplace, probably three different schools, because they're all going to have different opinions on what needs to happen and when. And then you're going to go back and, you know, if you're in, say, Krav Maga, and they're doing gun takeaways, Krav Maga, they don't have any, none of the places that I've been have a tactical firearms part where they teach you what to actually do with the gun once you get the gun. They practice the takeaways, but they don't practice, say, then creating space and moving back, and the guy that you took the gun away from 10 cops to tackle you and try and take the gun back.
Yeah.
So it's all these little pieces you have to keep pulled together. Which, yeah. And, you know, that's what happens.
Be your own master.
Yeah, be your own master. Figure it out. You're going to have to guide your own training, which means you're going to have to be engaged in it, which most people tend not to want to do in the beginning because they want things – people tend to want things to be easier. So they want to go one place and all the information comes to them from one place. But that's, you know, we have to be discerning individuals and seek out our own training and figure it out for ourselves.
Okay, so you train people with machetes and firearms, but you're also involved in dance and the aerial arts, which is something that I know nothing about. I mean, the closest thing I've ever done to aerial training is like climbing a rope. So can you just tell me a little bit about it? You know, what you do?
Aerial is like the perfect complement to martial arts or to CST. Aerial is perfect pulling. It's 6 degree of flow pulling, which means it's pulling in absolutely every direction. It's infinitely complex, right? There is no limit to what you can do in aerial. The tricks get more complex all the time, every year. Now with the advent of Instagram, the rate of evolution of aerial is going up even higher. But one of the ways that I think about training is three things, three categories. You have your ground-based movement, right, which is your body flow. You know, now people are calling it animal flow. You're calling it parkour. You have your ground-based movement, and then you have defense. That's category number two. And then category number three is climbing, an infinitely complex amount of climbing. The same way that parkour is to box jumps, aerial is to pull-ups. So you can be the best box jumper in the world. It doesn't mean you can run through a parking lot and do a slide over a car and jump a fence. Same thing is true of pull-ups. You can be, you know, you can do 25 pull-ups, but I can ask you to climb a rope upside down, and you'll have no idea what to do. So aerial is just such a great form of exercise for the brain. It meets all the needs of everything that you want to do. I'm not a dancer. I'm not involved in dance at all, which is why I don't get along with a lot of the aerialist community, is because they're all ex-dancers. And so they have a very specific language and a very specific type of movement, but oftentimes that's not my goal. My goal isn't to be a dancer. I don't care about that at all. But I do enjoy aerial. I do think it's a perfect form of exercise. That, you know, you can do until you're 90. So it meets all those CST requirements for what makes a good system. Mm-hmm. I train people in aerial. I train the basics. I never train the advanced of almost anything. I leave the advanced to specialists. So if, you know, you come to me for kettlebells, I'll train you with what I consider to be the fundamentals of kettlebelling. Come to me for CST, I'll train you for the fundamentals of CST. I'll make you really, really, really good at mills. If you come to me for aerial, I will focus on maybe 6 to 10 basic movement patterns, and I will then create levels within each one, right? Same way you would from a CST perspective for, say, flow fit.
But instead of levels 1 through 4, there will be levels 1 through 24 for these six different movements. Ariel meets a lot of needs. I'm sorry, I'm getting a little lost here.
No, that's cool. No worries. So when you, like as a coach, when you're coaching Ariel, is it, do you approach it as like just a skill to be mastered for its own sake, for something to be fun and interesting and a way to achieve health and fitness that way? Or is it like, is it more like a tool that you use to achieve specific goals that can't be achieved with other methods of training or can't be achieved as well? Am I making sense? Well, like, do you approach it as just a skill to be mastered? Does a client come to you and say, I just want to learn aerial just because it looks awesome? Or is it something that, you know, it's just for fitness, you know?
No, I don't believe in this, like, doing things for fitness benefits idea. I think that that's basically a lie that people tell very often to get people to come to a class. Like, aerial's a great way to get fit. And that's a complete lie. Aerial's not a great way to get fit. If you are not fit, you cannot do aerial. So I teach aerial as a skill to its own means, as basically another type of kung fu. It's a skill to be mastered, but it is not really a way to get fit. If you are fit, doing aerial makes you more fit and can keep you fit. But, like, if you can't climb a rope 20 feet in the air and invert, you really got nothing to do at aerial. So if I could just, like, yell at you for the next 6 months and tell you to climb this rope, and then eventually you might get good at it, but the odds of you doing that are extremely low. But if I take you and I teach you club belt, and I teach you the correct grip, and I make sure that there's muscles inside of your core, and then we go and we do skill-based work in aerial, then you will eventually learn the skill of aerial, and you will combine fitness that you already have or fitness that you get from, say, clubbing or kettlebelling with the movement patterns associated with aerial, and they will come together. But I never will tell somebody that aerial is a good way to get fit. It doesn't really meet any outside goals other than its own goal of aerial. So, like, doing aerial isn't going to make you better at, say, I don't know, what else could it possibly make you better at? I have no idea.
Yeah.
It's perfect pulling. You know, you'll get good at pulling on things, but you'll get good at pulling on things for the purpose of climbing and for climbing upside down and for climbing in increasingly complex ways. So if you're looking at it from, like, a parkour perspective, it meets the whole climbing need of parkour, one of the eight basic movement types of parkour, right? Boom, it's all right there. And there are multiple apparatuses, but those apparatuses, they tend not to translate to, say, like, solid bar work. So, like, now you see in the last 2 years, you see this big trend towards bar star stuff. An aerialist and a bar stars person cannot do the same things at all. So if you were to take a trapeze artist and you say it's a bar, they should be able to do what a bar stars person does, and a bar stars person should be able to do what a trapeze person does. That's not true at all. Because the movement patterns are fundamentally opposite to one another, because a trapeze moves and a bar doesn't. So the way that you push and pull on them are totally different. So,
skill specific.
Yes. Aerial is something that's great because it creates within people, throw out a CST phrase here, mental emotional preparedness, right? When people do pull-ups, they never really, there's no mental emotional preparedness aspect of doing pull-ups. It's just do pull-ups, which I personally hate. I can't do that many pull-ups. Because I really don't want to train them because I find them to be infinitely useless from an aerialist perspective. Once you can do a couple of pull-ups, you don't really need to be able to do 25. It's not going to make you any better at climbing ropes. You know, what's going to make you better at climbing ropes is climbing ropes.
That brings me up to one of the questions I was going to ask you later, is that, you know, you've been training people to be more prepared for, like, unpredictable, chaotic, and dangerous situations. Can you shed some light on, like, how you go about that? How do you prepare somebody for that? You know, you mentioned the mental and emotional preparedness and resiliency. You know, what can, like, other practical things that people can do, or how would you go about that?
For me, mental emotional preparedness is almost always about scenario training. It's always about doing something that makes you a little bit braver. So bringing you back to the aerialist point, doing pull-ups doesn't make you prepared to be 30 feet in the air upside down hanging by one knee. But doing aerial does help you prepare to do that. That trains you to be a bit more bold. It also trains you to be systematic and to do things that you know you can do and not things that you think you can do. So you kind of take a lot of you train yourself to take a lot of guesswork out of things, and you train yourself to actually know what you're doing, which is, it's not a huge stretch, but it is a huge stretch in the modern Western world. You know, the idea in the modern world is that, like, if you're fit, you can just do stuff, and that's not really true. A guy who can do 25 pull-ups cannot necessarily climb a rope 30 feet in the air and hang by his toes. That mental emotional preparedness that comes from learning increasingly complex and mildly dangerous skills makes you more resilient. So if you've never done anything hard in your entire life, the odds that you're going to be mentally resilient are very low. But doing things like aerial or doing your fight training, going to gun ranges, going to all these things, learning to deal with explosions, learning to deal with loud noises, doing scenario-based training, all of these things allow your brain to not wonder anymore about what would happen. You've actually acquired some amount of data on what would happen in these situations, and that allows you then to have resiliency, correct?
Right.
But physical fitness is a huge part of that. If your heart rate can't handle what happens when a gun comes out, if your heart rate spikes and suddenly your blood pressure goes crazy and you can't think anymore, it didn't do you any good. So there has to be this ground in the middle all the time, right? If you're 30 feet in the air and hanging by one foot, that only really works if your body knows that it's strong enough to hold on. So resiliency and all these mental aspects of training is you have to introduce danger slowly and incrementally over time. You have to expose situations. You have to change environments. But you also then have to have the level of fitness required in order for your body to handle those stress levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, kind of a similar line of thinking. I've trained in MoveNet for several years. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's kind of like a...
MoveNet Natural. It's like the parkour forest version.
Right. Yeah, the grandfather. And, MoveNet's really big on practicality, adaptability to your environment, your circumstances, and implementing risk and, like, a balance of risk and danger into your training, whereas risk and danger are distinct things, and we don't always have to train in dangerous situations to benefit training in risk. You know, like, you could practice in aerial, you could practice a move 1 foot off the ground, but it's a really high-risk move. It's very advanced for somebody, and there's a high likelihood that they fall, but if they do, they're only falling a foot. And you put them 30 feet over the air, they could kill themselves. So
yes, and that's the exact same thing that I'm saying. I like the way you said that, danger versus risk, right? You shouldn't be moving. You shouldn't be 30 feet in the air until you've done it at 1 foot, at 5 foot, at 10 feet, at 15 feet. And you need to walk your way up in some type of incremental progression. So that you know that you're going to live through it, which is dangerous, but now the risk is lower because you actually know you're going to survive it. It's riskier when you don't actually, if you've never done it down low and somebody tells you to do it up high, you tell that person to, to jump off a cliff because now that's dangerous and risky. So
you're
always finding a balance between these two things. Yes. So making things repeatable, but you have to expose yourself to these things. I like that idea that you just said from MoveNet. That's perfect. That is exactly what we're trying to do all the time. I think that this idea is coming up more and more and more in different systems as the world becomes safer and safer and safer. You know, when I was a roofer back in Ohio, I used to walk across, roof joists that were 20 feet in the high, and it was dangerous, but it wasn't risky because I knew I could do it, because I had that experience. But your average individual now in America will never walk across a beam 20 feet in the air over an undug basement. It just doesn't happen much anymore. People don't work on farms anymore, so they're not around threshers. You know, they don't learn not to stick their hand in threshers. Or, it's just the world has gotten very, very safe, so risk is required now to be put back into training in some way in order for people's brains to come to some type of risk versus reward level of homeostasis.
Yeah. All right. I want to get a touch back on the aerial training and then move on. You know, for anybody who is interested in getting into aerial for its own sake, would you recommend they get started? I mean, that's not something I venture a guess. You don't want to try that at home, right?
No, I would tell you there are people who do it naturally at home, but they're different types of people. Normally, people have some amount of instruction because there's a lot of secret knowledge in aerial, just like there is in every skill. Fire spinning has its own secret knowledge about how not to set yourself on fire or what the equipment actually is. So there's a specific equipment that is used for aerial that, you know, it has to be the right equipment. Otherwise, you're going to kill yourself. So, I mean, the only way to really do it is to go to an aerial school and begin learning that way. And then eventually, it's kind of like the way martial arts was a while back. There wasn't a lot of information on it, so you had to go someplace and train there and show your dedication so that they would tell you what the correct equipment is, and then you could go out and learn to train it on your own. But, you know, I would never recommend people really train aerial on their own because you're always one move away from death in aerial. Like, it sounds dramatic, but it is pretty true. Your body's not really meant to fall any height further than your own, say, head height. Like, that's about as far as you can fall flat onto the ground and live through it without a lot of serious damage. You get up to twice your own height, now you're getting into very injurious territory. Three times your height, it's really looking bad for you. Four times your own height, it is, you know, you're not coming out of this without major medical injury. So I do not recommend people ever train aerial alone, but the best way to get into it is still always going to be to find somebody who knows and go to them and ask them.
Yeah, I figured that's what you'd say. All right, next question. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you see most fitness enthusiasts or athletes making? You know, just the stuff that you just notice over and over again.
Lack of lateral stability of the spine, always. Uh-huh. Almost always. Lack of rotation in training. I see people who are very, very, very strong, much stronger than I am with a barbell. Right? I have no barbell skill. Don't really train it. But, you know, they can deadlift 300-400 pounds, but I hand them a 10-pound club bell, and they can't control it and save their life. You know, so I see just people have holes in their training, usually based on rotation and almost always based on leverage. So those are the major holes that I see. The other ones that you see all the time are people pick one thing or the other. They do cardio or they lift weights, but they never cross back and forth in between them. If you do kettlebells or club bells, you don't have to worry about that because the weight and the cardio are the same thing. You always see the same problems with yoga people. Yoga people do yoga all the time, but then they never pick up anything heavy. So they might be very bendy, but their functional ability in the real world is not very good because they can't pick up their niece or their nephew and run around with them because they don't have any practice with offset center of mass load.
Yeah,
go ahead.
It's just a common theme of people not working on their weaknesses and always being so specialized in something that they're really interested in like the marathon runner who never lifts weights or the boxer who never does any groundwork, you know.
Yeah. So everybody, whatever you're good at, you'll do it. So, you know, it's always humbling experience to go. Like, I constantly do aerial because I am not supposed to be an aerialist. Like, genetically, I'm 220 pounds. I'm 6'2". I'm a farm boy with no dance training. Like, I should not be doing aerial. There's no reason in hell that I should be doing it, but that's why I do it. because I'm not good at it, because it forces me to examine things. So the major problem that you see with all people across all physical spectrums is that they do exactly what they're good at or exactly what they did when they were young, and they never branch out beyond that to something uncomfortable for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've found that the best, you know, for your average athlete, your average fitness enthusiast, the best thing they can do is cover a few bases. You know, if you just cover a few bases, the mobility training, the strength training, the cardiovascular training, and, you know, supplement off of that, you know, you're going to be 99% better than the vast majority of people. Go ahead.
No, go for it. Go.
Okay, well, I read that you had some major knee surgeries and that your doctors, of course, instructed you to avoid athletic pursuits. Obviously, you've ignored their advice. But I just wanted to hear, like, how did you overcome the injuries and get back to training at such a high level? You know, walk me through that process, because a lot of the people that I work with, they're injured. They've got old aches and pains. I had knee problems for years that debilitated me. I just want to hear your perspective and your story on that.
I had very, very, very major knee surgeries. I had a PCL disruption, LCL disruption, popliteus tendon disruption, and meniscus tear all at one time, all related to aerial arts. So if you fall 25 feet, you know, you're going to get major injuries. I got hurt training in maybe 2008, and that's when I stopped listening to other aerial coaches tell me what to do for the most part, because I realized that they weren't communicating with me effectively, and I couldn't. I was attempting to do what they said, but you should not always attempt to do what somebody tells you to do. You have to figure out what's right and what's wrong. When people tell you to do things and you're like, well, that seems like a terrible idea, you should probably listen to yourself and just acknowledge it's a terrible idea. Otherwise, you end up like me, falling 20, 25 feet, dislocating your knee entirely, ripping it basically off your body, and then having to go through basically a two-year rehabilitation process. So aerial is very dangerous. It is a great thing you can pursue, but be paranoid and don't do everything people tell you to do. You know, think for yourself. I basically dislocated my leg, relocated it myself, which is apparently not what you're supposed to do because you can accidentally kill yourself. I went to the hospital, but because I was in such good shape, they basically told me that I hadn't hurt myself, and I told them that I had dislocated my leg. They wouldn't believe me because I walked in. I did duct tape my leg to a board, but I did walk into the hospital, you know, and it took a long time for me to convince them to give me, you know, x-rays and everything else, but I couldn't convince them to give me an MRI because they didn't want to pay for it. So they gave me x-rays, and they said, none of your bones are broken, you're fine. They sent me home. So I went around for about 3 months with a completely ripped in half leg until I finally convinced the doctor to give me an MRI. Against his orders, by the way. He didn't think it was necessary because I was walking and I was taking care of myself. I finally got the MRI. The doctors had a panic attack because they were like, oh, my God, you could actually kill yourself on accident if this thing once again dislocates because it could sever the artery in your leg. So I then had to wait another, 2 months for surgery. I can't remember. You know, so it was an emergency, but it wasn't an emergency. I ended up going in for a first surgery where they did what they call them, allograft. Basically, they put zombie parts in your leg. They take dead people parts. They bolt them into your leg. For the LCL and the PCL, they stitched the popliteus tendon back together as best they could, and they stitched up the meniscus as best they could. They told me that I would never run again or fight again or do aerial again. You know, I'd be lucky to, you know, walk without a limp, really. And I just did not think that was something that I was willing to do at the age of 28. I wasn't willing to become a 90-year-old man at the age of 28. I had plenty of stuff I still wanted to do. So I did everything that they said. I stayed off of it for as long as they said. The day that they told me to, I could put weight back on it, I went back over and I picked up my 10-pound club bell and I started over. I have a very long and weird mathematical way that I do club bell training. And I basically did it all over again. I did 2 years of physical therapy. My leg had actually grown into a straight leg from all the surgery. The scar tissue had made it straight like a tree trunk. It wouldn't bend at all. So I had to get a second surgery 6 months later, where they went in, they cut the scar tissue in half and then broke, basically, they call it breaking, where they break the rest of the scar tissue by bending your leg.
Yeah, it's not
super fun. So I did that. I went back to physical therapy again. I started over with my club belts again. Went through all of my training repeated now for basically a third time in my life. And then 6 months after that, I had yet another surgery to go back in and do to cut some more scar tissue. And they pulled out some screws that they had left in there because the screws were now inhibiting the motion of my knee. In some way. So I had three major surgeries over the course of 2 years, physical therapy the entire time, and I just restarted everything from the beginning. Very hard. It's not a lot of fun. Physical therapy twice a week. I did massage therapy then for the next year or 2 years after that, twice a week. I still do it to this day. But, you know, I can do aerial now again, which they told me I would never do. I can run again, which they told me I would never do. I do all of my club bell training. I do fight training. I'm a little bit more paranoid now. If you're doing grappling, I definitely try to keep people away from my knee as much as possible. But, you know, you have to go back through this process of rebuilding it, and it's basically awful and terrible. But, you know, unless you're willing to just become 90 at the age of 28, you have to do something.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit every day, and you just basically make a big mathematical plan, and you just put up with it until it stops hurting. And it took about 3 years for it to stop hurting. When I first went back to aerial, it was awful because your brain, you do a lot of stuff where you hang off of your knee in aerial, and you would just, your body would go into basically involuntary panic convulsions where your body goes through the thing of going, do not do that, do not do that. So it sends out all the hormonal signals and floods that cause your body, essentially as if somebody, you know, had stabbed you or something else like that. Like your body goes through that same process and you keep going and you do it slowly and incrementally and you expose yourself to it. Eventually, now my body doesn't have that response anymore. I will never be a great aerialist. My leg simply does not bend enough for me to fully accomplish with ease the majority of the techniques of aerial, but I'm going to keep doing aerial forever. So,
yeah. Oh, that's a cool story. I'm glad that, you know, you didn't take no for an answer when those doctors told you not to do anything.
The doctors will tell you all kinds of terrible stuff. Yeah, they will lie to you. They will tell you all kinds of things. Like they told me I would be up and around 6 weeks after my surgery. Total lie. I had a leg cast on for almost 3 months, was non-wavering for over 3 months. You know, like the doctors, I appreciate what they do. They have a lot of liability. They have a lot of things that they need to do. But, you know, what your doctor tells you is not almost always the truth because he almost always has to tell you something very specific. So there, you know, you're never going to run again is just not acceptable to me in any way.
Yeah.
So
that was the same for me because I was told that by a couple doctors when I was 17, and I run now, you know. And so
yeah,
it was the same thing. It was a long multi-year process of getting back to that level and a lot of trial and error that's kind of how I found CST. That was a big part of the process. So.
You know, I already had CST at that point for a couple of years, but club bells are probably the greatest rehab, prehab, and strength training tool that there could be because when you get hurt, you just go back down from the 45 to the 10, and you just start over. Mm-hmm. And you might go up twice as fast as you did the first time you learned it, but you will reinstitute and rebuild that confidence, that body awareness and that mental emotional preparedness for every one of those movement patterns that you have. Because there's, you know, there's a mental emotional preparedness for every movement pattern that your body has. And you just repeat them until your body stops panicking. You know, my squat pattern was off for at least 3 years. It's still a little bit off. I have to watch it literally every squat I do forever. But, like, that's one of the reasons that I won't do barbell, is because barbell is a symmetrical load on my asymmetrical body. Mm-hmm. So it makes the problems worse instead of making the problems better. My body doesn't pull itself to the center. My body gets crushed apart when I try and do things like that. So you just, TST is a great way of basically making you smarter and making you think more about all of your fitness goals and the way that you move. And when you get hurt, you're forced to really examine what are the priorities. Is the priority right now to have six-pack abs, or is the priority to be able to walk without a limp? You know, and if your priority is to walk without a limp, you can get back to your six-pack abs easier, but you have to start with what's the most important thing and come up with a scientific, logical plan for that and then move forward from there.
Right. And it's always, we don't learn that lesson until after something bad has happened. And it's like a lesson that every older person, every senior trainee learns. Like, okay, I don't really care about looking amazing in a swimsuit or looking like a bodybuilder. I just want to be able to, like, climb that set of stairs without being out of
breath
at the top and in pain. And that's why, you know, it's important to get your priorities right. And that's one of the reasons why I like CST so much, is it's health first fitness. And it you know, prioritizes things totally different from the mainstream fitness culture, with health at the top and mobility below that.
Health, mobility, then strength, then performance, then how you look. Like, you know, your health is always first. If you're pain-free movement, then we're doing good. That's what's very different about the way I train here in LA than other trainers. Other trainers, you know, I want you to be able to live through your shoot or whatever. Other trainers don't have that concern. They want you to be as sexy as possible, even if it kills you. But if they kill you and you can't do the movie, what was the point of the training?
Yeah. Right. All right. So you do a lot of traveling. I gather you do a lot of traveling. What have you learned about fitness from other cultures around the world that you think people in the USA would benefit from?
Walking. I mean, most cultures, like, you know, Europe was basically built before the advent of cars. You know, Europe has been Europe for 1,000 years. So a lot of the cities are very, very old. And so when you walk around cities like London or around Rome, there are cities that were originally designed for walking around. So the city, you can walk all around the entire city in not a huge amount of time. And walking is that thing that, because most of America is settled after the invention of cars, Los Angeles is a great example of this. Los Angeles was never designed as a walking city. There's a small portion of it downtown that was built in the 1880s, back when people actually walked. But, you know, Los Angeles is almost 20 miles across. So it's not designed for walking in any way. The most important thing from any culture is most cultures walk, whereas we don't. If we walk, we would not have the majority of the health problems that we have in America. I mean, that's the one you see the most everywhere you go, because America's the new place, you know, majority being settled after the highway system in the 1940s, World War II highway system, right? So before that, people lived in small isolated communities, and they lived on farms, and they just didn't travel all that much. Now in America, we all travel by car all the time, everywhere we go. Whereas if you were, say, in London, you still walk to the grocery store. You walk to the subway. You ride the subway, you walk to where you're going, you walk home. The culture is still based heavily on walking. So a lot of the places I go, that's the thing that I see the most. You know, most people don't really have a fitness culture like we do in America, because for a lot of part, it's not as necessary. Like, we have created a fitness culture in America because we lack walking. So we have to do something to make up for that every day, and then we come up with these engineering answers. How do I make the most use out of 20 minutes of time, or the most use out of 30 minutes of time? Whereas in other countries, they might work out. They walk to sports, they play sports, they walk home.
Right. Yeah, sometimes it's the simplest things that make the biggest difference. And, you know, I love talking training and the geek stuff too. But for the vast majority of people, if they just started getting, you know, some more exercise, whether it's walking or anything, and just eating a little better, getting enough sleep, not being so stressed out, 99% of the problems with our health of our culture would just disappear.
Awesome. Yeah. So, you know, the majority of the world plays soccer. You know, the majority of the world plays soccer, which is a 90-minute running sport they play a couple of times a week. I spent a couple of weeks in Italy working on a project, and all the guys who worked at the hotel, they all just played soccer every day. They played 90 minutes of soccer every day.
Uh-huh.
And there was the off-season for them. They weren't even, like, playing competitively right now, but they were all thinking towards competition season. And so they played, you know, every day except probably Sunday or whenever they went to church. You know, so they had a very different type of build. But, you know, the majority of the world just operates on playing football.
Yeah, yeah, that's so cool. And it's so simple other places, it seems like, and it's just so complicated here. Or, you know, it doesn't have to be, but it's become complicated.
Yeah.
All right. I have a feeling that some of the people listening to this would like me to ask you if you train your celebrity clients any differently than your non-celebrity clients. Because I think there's this idea that, you know, the celebrities, you know, everything has to be different for them. They look amazing. They must train, you know, 8 hours a day and have all their meals prepared by a private chef, you know, et cetera. And maybe some of that's true for some of them. But do you train your celebrity clients any differently than your firefighters or any other more ordinary, quote-unquote, folks?
No, not really. Maybe 5% different here or there, but, I mean, not even that. Maybe 1% different. For the most part, everybody needs the same type of training, right? If I don't care if you're a lawyer or an actor. Like, actors might have more time, and they might have some kind of more entertaining training goals. Like, they might be more interested in doing fight training than your average individual. Your average individual might be more interested in just learning fitness, club bell, kettlebell, body flow, tack fit. Whereas actors might have more interest in they're doing an action movie, so they might need to work more on get-ups with a gun or, you know, learning how to throw a good kick or jumping over a table and throwing a kick. But for the most part, it's no different. I don't change any of the fundamentals of training are not changed at all. If anything, we do more fundamental training with a lot of actor clients. I don't they're no different from any other client to me.
I figured that was the case, and I think for a lot of people that's probably going to be reassuring because, you know, a lot of people think, oh, I'm never going to, you know, look like that or be able to perform like that, but it's not as out of reach as a lot of people seem to think it is.
It's not really out of reach at all. I mean, for the majority, actors are actually working a lot more than your average blue-collar worker, and that's not meant to be offensive or anything, but yeah, an actor can be up at 4 o'clock in the morning and not be home until 10 o'clock at night, and that can happen 6 to 7 days a week when they're on a project. So they actually usually have less time than your average individual to do things. So they might have food coming from a chef, but that's literally because they would have absolutely no time to do it on their own because their days are controlled so precisely. In order to get schedules done. But, you know, it's not unheard of for actors to work 14 to 16 hours a day for 6 months at a time. So if, you know, anything, you get less time when you're actually on a project with actors than you would if they're not on a project. If they're not on a project, then you get your hour a day. If they're on a project, you might get 24 minutes, you know. It's like everything is very, very controlled and precise. So you just, nothing really changes in the training. That's why the training has to be good and well thought out in the first place. But they have less time than normal people do to, you know, take care of their health.
Yeah, yeah, I hear you. Cool. All right, a couple more questions, and then we'll wrap up. What's something that you wish, I ask this to a lot of people I interview, what's something that you wish you knew about training when you were younger and still just getting started? You know, if you could go back and tell your younger self, you need to know this, what would it be?
Volume cycles and density cycles.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Explain.
Volume cycles is a concept from RKC. If you want to be better at something, don't add intensity, which means don't add reps to your sets. So don't do 5 sets of 5 and then do 5 sets of 6 and then 5 sets of 7. It doesn't work like that. Add sets, so volume cycles. So 5 sets of 5 becomes 6 sets of 5 becomes 7 sets of 5 becomes 8 sets of 5. So you're adding work capacity and you're adding volume, but you're not changing intensity. Really wish somebody would have told me that 30 years ago. That would have really been good to know. That's the most important concept that I know in all of training. Is volume cycle. Volume cycle, volume cycle from now until the end of days.
Now, is that because you think it is it more sustainable? Like, I'm wondering what's the rationale behind it, because I know, you know, I know what I think about it, but I also know there's people who disagree with that and say it should be intensity, intensity, intensity. So what's your thinking behind it?
Part one, practice. If you're constantly changing intensity, you're not going to get good at stuff. Relate this back to aerial. If you try and go instantly up in intensity while you're 30 feet in the air and you fail, you fall to your horrible death, right? So you'd much rather go up and repeat the exact same thing the exact same way 5 times today, 6 times tomorrow, 10 times next week. So you're still, you're getting more training time, you're getting more training experience, and you're getting more practice, but you're doing it in a way that's less likely to kill you. And that, the example is very apparent in aerial, because if your hands get tired from too much intensity, then you can't actually fall to your death. The difference is people aren't thinking about all of their training like that. They're thinking about their normal fitness training as something different than skills training. I treat pretty much everything as skills training, because skills training is kind of the only thing that really matters. You know, you can do more sit-ups today and burn out and, you know, look good tomorrow, but what effect does that really have on you long term? Long term, the only thing that stays is skill, because conditioning can fade up and down. So a volume cycle allows you to practice things at the same intensity more each time, which allows you to have better technique. Technique is what stays. The movement patterns associated with technique are what really increase fitness, in my mind. So, yeah, I think that that's the most important thing that I wish anybody would have told me at any point in training.
Uh-huh.
It would have been really good to know.
Kind of along the same lines. I mean, I know all these things are, variables and changeable, but are you more of a high-frequency training guy or a minimum effective dose, use each in the right situation? You know, where do you fall on that spectrum?
How much training people need is entirely determined on how much training they previously had. So if somebody comes in and they're a competitive gymnast, or they were a competitive gymnast, then I can do minimum effective dose with them because they've already have 30,000 hours of training. So, but if somebody comes in with absolutely no athletic background of any type, then I have to start figuring out a way to make the most effective training, but I have to make up for the fact that there's no 20,000 hours of training built into that person. So more training for people who have less experience, for the simple fact that I'm trying to get their brain to accrue X amount of data so that their brain will draw X conclusion.
Yeah.
So back and forth based on experience. If somebody's very, very experienced, you can get away with probably less training.
And right. And not, they usually train harder, you know, just because they're more experienced, because they can train harder.
They can train harder. They already have a lot of the movement patterns. There's a lot less lag time. With people with less athletic experience, you have to go through and you have to build up, you know, lunge patterns, and you have to build up side lunge patterns, front lunge patterns, dragon stances, pullovers, standing up straight, squat patterns. All those things and all that stuff takes time because there's a specific amount of data that they have to have in order to make those conclusions good. So you know, back and forth. It's always a question. It's an engineering equation that you're always playing with the variables.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, it sounds like, you know, that's the way it should be done. It's the smart way to do it. All right, one more technical question. What advice would you give to somebody who wants to work towards a really high standard of fitness or performance and, you know, achieve what people would consider extraordinary success over the long term? You know, could you kind of like decode the process of pursuing mastery for a person?
Volume cycles.
Okay.
So volume cycles. So let's take Ariel. Ariel's always a good example because I have lots of problems with the way that people train Ariel. People usually train Ariel steps 1 through 34, go. So an aerialist will get up there. They're usually an ex-dancer. An ex-dancer has an extreme ability to understand large amounts of complex data. And they have an innate ability of fitness because they have, you know, 10 years of dance training. So when that person gets up there, they'll tell you steps 1 through 34, go. And you'll do it maybe 3 times before everybody's fracked out. I do not do things like that at all. I will start with step 1, do step 1 on the left, do step 1 on the right, go back, step 1, 2, left, step 1, 2, right, step 1, 2, 3, left, step 1, 2, 3, right. Break it down. Build it up, allow you to have the process of developing the movement patterns over and over and over again, and then you build up to a certain amount. You train for, say, an hour in aerial, as far as you get, and then come back and don't change anything. Repeat that same exact thing, you know, 6 times on 6 different days, not consecutively, but repeat that exact same training pattern 6 times in six times over 6 non-consecutive days. Because that's going to allow you to find all the little things in the middle. All the little things in the middle are what really lead to mastery. It's not the overall end product. It's not steps 1 through 34. It's being good at steps 1 to 2 and steps 1 to 3 and steps 5 to 8 and finding out all those little pieces in the middle. And that's almost always accomplished best through some type of volume cycle training where you control the intensity and you make things repeatable, breaking down from small pieces to complex pieces, pull things apart, and repeat them ad infinitum. That's how you get good at stuff. It's not usually by training as hard as possible. It's not by insane levels of intensity. You know, insane levels of intensity has its place, but I don't see where it helps a lot of things. Training super intensity in fighting doesn't matter if you can't actually hit the target, you know? So I'd rather you hit the target 1,000 times, a little bit harder every time, than train as hard as possible and hit the target once. So it's, for me, it's always a numbers game. It's a math game. It's always an engineering equation of how do I get enough repeatability and enough, let's call them data points for your brain to draw a statistical conclusion, which is improved movement patterns, which is fitness, which is technique, which is getting good at stuff, which is mastery.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, hey, that's all the questions I've got. So thank you very much, Mark.
Okay.
I really enjoyed this interview. It was awesome. And love to do it again sometime to pick your brain more about some other stuff. Because I came up with 20 questions for this interview because I was like, I don't want to bombard him with more than that. We did 20.
Yeah.
Well, I skipped over a couple because you covered them before I'd asked them.
Okay.
Yeah, we covered a lot. So one last question, though. Where is the best place for somebody to find more information about you and your work?
Probably Instagram. Because it's the easiest format. You can take a picture or you can take a video of something that's really immediate, and you can put it up right then and put up thoughts on it right then. All the other formats are a little bit too slow for me right now. I would like to do something more involved later, but for right now, Instagram,
okay.
The Mark Wildman.
The Mark Wildman.
The
Mark Wildman. Okay. I'll put a link to that below the interview.
Yeah,
right. Well,
it's mostly aerial and stuff. We don't cover a lot of club bells and things. It's hard to really talk about club bells in a visual format. Club bells are a harder thing to discuss because they are less sexy looking than, say, aerial or fight training or machete fighting or anything like that. Like, doing the long, slow, rhythmic work of club bells that actually is going to improve all those other things doesn't transfer really to a lot of different formats. You know, it really is something you have to personally, internally experience. So, but Instagram's probably the best way to learn more about what we do.